Hear me now. Sorry. Let's not be silly. Just put a mic in my hand. I just want to give you a few reminders that I gave to all of you who were at worship this morning. I wanted to tell Jeff separately to remind you, but I didn't, so don't try not to look too surprised here. But today is the day that the small group leaders and the... this doesn't sound like it's on. Can you hear me?
Oh, it's
on. The small group leaders and the planning committee will have lunch with Jeff in the west dining room. So we're going to go through the line first, and I'm going to see if I can get us to go through a few minutes early instead of waiting till 12:30 on the dot. Yes, right. So, because this is, if we just take a check-in midway in the conference to make sure that if the small group leaders want to add anything or tell Jeff anything, they want to report anyone being really naughty in their group, this is the time to do that. The business meeting is this afternoon at 1:30. That will also be in the West Dining Room. If you want to see how Quaker process could work, come and sit in on the business meeting. It's rather interesting. Should be even more interesting this year. And I believe, are there any other, the talent show. Yes, please. If you haven't signed up, please do. As I said, we have all the poets in the group have signed up already, all 39 of them. So, and one singer. So if,
not all
39. Oh, not all 39. Oh, half of the 39. So if anyone, this is not to, 20, yes, we love you poets. But if anyone else has a talent, it can be anything, reading a poem, doing a dance. Imitating someone, which is great fun, let me tell you. But anything like that, if you wish to come. That's at 9:30 tonight. If the small groups end on time, they can all get over here for the talent show, so we're not up till 12 o'clock. So everyone be conscious of that, please. And I think that's everything, unless one of you asked me to announce something and I didn't. Yes, Dorothy. Dorothy, thank you so much. Dorothy is reminding us that just by being here, you are all members. And as a member, do Quakers have obligations? You have an you have an invitation, a very strong invitation. You have a call. Wow. Yeah, right. Anyway, the business meetings are 1:30. Members need to be there. All right. The only other thing I was thinking of is we have, thank you so much. You've brought many, many wonderful books to the Share One, Take One. I noticed that we've got an awful lot of Share Ones, not many Take Ones. So if you don't start clearing that table, all of you who took one, I mean brought one, you will have to take it back with you. And my comment to you would be if you brought it to give it away and no one wanted it, that may be a very clear indication that it's time to recycle the book. Or give it to your local library, one or the other, all right? So if there are no other things that I can think of, I'm sorry, that's a terrible way to introduce you.
Okay.
Nothing else I can think of. Here's Jeff.
They know me anyway.
With that, how about if we go into a few moments of quiet worship and Jeff will speak to us out of the silence.
So, good morning. I'd like to, I've been visiting the groups and chatting with folks over meals, getting a little feedback, getting a little barometer check. This is easier to do again. If you have 4 months, if you have 4 days, it has to come pretty quickly. Something that, you know, has come up, a couple things have come up over and over again. One, by the way, is neuroscience in my conversations, about which I know very little, but we'll be addressing sort of obliquely tomorrow. So we'll get there eventually. The other, I think, is there. Bonnie and I had, I think, a very constructive conversation over breakfast, and she encouraged me, I think, correctly, to sort of return before we get going today to yesterday and kind of get a handle on what I mean by the psychological turn. That was a bit unclear, and I think we need to go back to that before we can move forward. And so I want to say a few more words about that. And then to this morning, I want to then move into our first case study. If you recall, the four lectures or plenaries, the plan was the first night to tell you a bit about myself and to sort of set the mood and to develop a relationship that we could build on. The second lecture was designed to paint a large canvas in which we could place this third way of being religious. And then the next 2 days, which is today and tomorrow, were essentially case studies about how this might work in a very practical, embodied, day-to-day fashion. So today we're going to be looking at gender and sexuality. And tomorrow we're going to be looking at anomalous and psychical phenomena. We actually had a beautiful example of that in the meeting today when Jean shared her dream of the woman plopping down a pile of white sheets. Dreams actually are the number one place where precognitive and psychical phenomena happen. So that's a very classic example of that. We'll be addressing that tomorrow. But let's start. I want to return to the psychological turn. And I guess there's a number of ways to do this. I guess the first thing to say is that it's not a matter of whether people are religious or not, it's how they're religious. And people are religious differently in different historical periods. Before the modern period, say before 1800, people tended to believe that their religious beliefs were given to them, that they were revealed in an absolute fashion, and that more or less they could not be questioned. And they more or less didn't question them. Most people would have been born and lived and died within, a 50-mile radius, right? Think 14th century France or something. So your worldview is relatively homogenous. It goes relatively unquestioned. And you assume that what the church teaches or what what the Quran says or what the Gita says or whatever it is out there. And you're embedded in that worldview, and it's not unproblematic, but it's relatively unproblematic. What happens in the 19th and 20th century is that breaks down rather significantly and rather quickly. And it breaks down through two major moves in the West. One is through colonialism, actually. As the British and the European colonial powers spread throughout the world, they encountered other cultures and other religions that they soon discovered were just as old or older than European Christianity, and which were and still are extremely sophisticated. So it became impossible to continue to say that the Western Christian worldview was the only way to be human, to be religious. The second thing that happened was science. Science was goes back, of course, as far as we want to take it. But really in the 19th century with geology and then Darwinian biology and eventually with astronomy and physics and chemistry and on and on, this really exploded a lot of the mythical universes that religious people lived in. Along with those developments comes this appreciation for other ways of being religious. And it's no accident that it's in the very same time that the terms mysticism and spirituality arise at the exact same time in the middle of the 19th century. There was no mysticism before the 19th century. Okay? In the early church fathers, they spoke of mystical readings of the scriptures, which were essentially esoteric or secret readings, interpretations of biblical passages. In the medieval church, there was something called mystical theology, which was probably best represented by Meister Eckhart. But there was no mysticism. Nobody would have said, I'm practicing mysticism before the 19th century. And the same is true with spirituality. There was no spirituality before the 19th century. There were certainly people having religious and spiritual experiences, but they never would have spoken in those terms. Okay? So what those terms encapsulate and capture is this psychological turn that I'm talking about. It's the realization that my religious experiences that I'm having or that I had are not absolute. The Hindu or the Buddhist or the Taoist or the Sioux Indian does not need to have my religious experiences because they're in a different culture, they speak a different language, and therefore they will have a different experience of the sacred. Okay? That's an incredibly radical move. We assume that, I think. And I think this is why we had a hard time understanding it yesterday, because it's so obvious to us now that this is the case. But we have to understand how modern that is and how radical that is with respect to other cultures and other times. This then is radicalized further when you get to figures like Freud and Jung. Freud, of course, saw religious imagery and religious symbolism as illusion, as a projection of the way people were raised by their parents. Okay? Jung didn't go that way, but he saw religious symbols as mediators between the human being and the community and the sacred. These were the famous archetypes and the symbolic and ritual systems that allowed human beings in different historical periods to get close to the sacred without being destroyed by it. Okay, this is the image of the nuclear reactor what I was proposing yesterday. What happens in the 20th century is that Freud and Jung and the whole broad sweep of psychology becomes essentially a way of being religious. This is how people, many, many people in this seeker modality approach the sacred throughout the 20th century and today. And this is, I would suggest, why you've held this conference for how many decades on Jung and Quakerism. Because the psychology of religion, particularly in its Jungian forms, has become psychology as religion. And that's entirely appropriate. This is what Jung was all about. I'm sure you know Jung better than I do, but he was raised by this, his father was a minister, and the dogmas and teachings of the Christian church simply made no sense to him anymore. They were dead. They didn't work. And so he turned to psychology and eventually depth psychology to make sense of our religious nature in a way that made sense to a modern man or woman. Okay? But to do that, he turned to psychology, not to the church, not to a scriptural text, not to a religious authority, but to these psychological categories that we're all familiar with. There's a sociologist named Peter Berger who wrote a little book. He's most famous for a book called The Sacred Canopy, which I highly recommend. But he wrote another, The Sacred Canopy. But he wrote another little book called The Heretical Imperative. And what he meant by the heretical imperative is what I just said. The word heresy comes from the Greek heresia, and the Greek word means choice or opinion. A heresy in the traditional church was when an individual or a community listened to their own opinions over the authority of the church. And that then created a schism, a breakaway. And that's what a heresy was. It was following your own lights. It was taking your own religious experiences more seriously than the teachings of the church and the scriptures. That's what heresy was. Okay? For Peter Berger, we are all heretics now. We have no choice but to be heretics. Because we know about religious pluralism. We know that the faith we were raised in is not the absolute faith for all places and all times. It just happens to be the one we were born into. So we have to choose whether to adopt that faith or to adopt another faith. And that's what Berger calls the heretical imperative. It's what I'm calling the psychological turn. Okay? And it changes everything, I think, about how someone is religious. Yeah. Right. I'm not in any way denying that people had what we call mystical experiences before the modern world. Obviously they did. All I'm saying is they didn't talk about them with this abstract noun called mysticism. I'm suggesting that that noun, like the noun spirituality, like the phrase psychology of religion, function in our world to remove us from any singular religious vision and to allow us to seek and to experiment and to try different things out. Yes, Vaughn.
I think the term coming into being, the way they are, the way they function in the culture, the terms themselves suggest a methodology, an approach.
Yeah.
The way a religious methodology suggests an approach. So it's not like coming and have this for an individual only. It now becomes a cultural phenomenon.
Right.
Can join together and engage, and they developing a system, a methodology, an approach to the psyche that's now got this term, a label called mysticism.
That's right. It's a way of being religious.
Waiting in the way that a church is waiting for the culture.
Right.
Okay.
Bonnie, is there a mic?
No. Yeah.
Bonnie, could you just repeat that and re-articulate it?
The inference. When the term... Oh, stand up. All right. What Jeff is... A translation for me is that you're suggesting and actually saying that as this really revolution or turn became evident, beginning to produce evidence of itself in American society, in the culture, a label, for lack of a better word at the moment, called mysticism, a label called spirituality or spiritualism, suggest that there is a methodology, a ritual form that can be taught, reproduced, shared. A shared meaning system comes into being so that that no longer is an individual who has mystical experiences outside something, but they have a container that's a shared meaning system, a culture, a subculture within a culture in which the techniques, the methodologies like dream work, amplification, active imagination, sitting in silence together, meditation, can be taught and by masters to initiates in the way that religious traditions have always been passed. And that systematized, broad-based, culturally formed patterning had not existed before the late 19th century. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay. Thank you.
Excellent translation. Please.
I don't understand what you're saying about people just accepted what had been handed down to them until the 1800s or something like that. In the 1600s, of course, this is when the Quakers started, but they weren't alone. There were all sorts of seekers that didn't accept what was handed down to them. And I guess it was partly they now had the Bible printed that they could read for themselves and just didn't accept it. And then, you know, the Protestant Reformation, what about that? So
right.
People were not accepting
right.
what had been handed down.
No, that's absolutely right. We can take that further back. We can, I mean, obviously Jesus didn't accept the purity codes of Judaism, or Muhammad didn't accept, you know, the tribal religions of Saudi Arabia, or the Buddha didn't accept the caste system of Hinduism. I mean, this goes way, way back. I'm not just arguing that at all. But people like Fox, or people like Martin Luther, or people like Jesus, they hadn't made the move yet that all religious systems on the planet are basically integral, genuine approaches to the sacred. They were always working within their own cultural frame. And they were protesting against some aspect or some version of their cultural frame, but they weren't leaping out of their cultural frame. That's the psychological turn, is when you leap entirely out of your cultural frame. Actually, you can never do it entirely, but you do it in a more radical fashion than was possible. And I'm not blaming Martin Luther or George Fox or Jesus or Muhammad. They lived in a different world. There wasn't telecommunication. There wasn't there weren't planes to fly people all over. There was global communication, but it was very slow, and it was along trade routes. So you could look at the psychological turn as a turning the knob up on that process. So, yes.
Wait. Stand up, please.
Friends, can I simply ask you to respect this gentleman who has come to us with a prepared speech for a plenary? He has been generous in answering questions, but can we please respect the work he has put into being our guest as plenary speaker? Thank you.
I'm still up.
Go ahead.
I heard you use faith in my remembrance for the first time today, and
yeah.
I wondered if you would discuss just short, briefly, faith and religion, how you distinguish them or you're using them. It's more loose, whatever. Thank you very much.
Okay. Boy, that's a big black box.
How you're using it or what we
Well, I think how I used faith earlier was I talked about faith and family and how I was raised. And so I mean the total worldview that one grows up in and assumes to be all-encompassing, but at some point realizes is not all-encompassing. But we can talk about faith in a different sense of this urge to make sense of the world and to move beyond whatever we can see and feel with our senses. I mean, I don't want to define faith for you, but I'm using it in a fairly simple sense of the worldview, the religious worldview that one grows up in. That's how I'm using it. Okay, let me say one more thing about this issue and then move on to a completely different issue, sexuality and gender. Two more things, actually. Another thing that came up in my conversations with you is that sometimes the seeker actually finds something. In other words, the seeker doesn't have to seek forever, always. I mean, some of us do. Some of us are eternally lost. But other seekers find and land and adopt a tradition or a community. But again, I would suggest that adoption is very different than growing up in a tradition 300 years ago. After you've sought for a decade or two decades or three decades, and then you consciously choose to adopt a community or a worldview, that's a very different act than just growing up and insisting that your culture or your worldview is the right one. That's very, very different. And so again, I want you to realize how unique historically and culturally your situation is, And I want you to recognize that it comes with heavy, heavy costs for people who grow up in other cultures. Okay? And I think that speaks to its power. That's not a criticism. That speaks to its power. Okay, so enough on that. Okay, today's topic is sex and spirit. And this is very much related to the psychological turn again, because the study of sexuality arose at the same time again, late 19th, early 20th century. There was no study of human sexuality before the 19th century. Okay? Not in any systematic fashion again. There were certainly precursors and important precursors to Freud, but it's really Freud and psychoanalysis that raises sexuality as the core topic of a psychology and of the humanities. Today, in the humanities, the three topics that really control all of the humanities, and by the humanities I mean philosophy, history, the study of religion, art history, language study, all of these things that you take in a typical college education. The three major topics are race, class, and gender. That's really what defines the humanities. And the humanities, the study of the humanities in the universities and colleges today. So the study of gender and sexuality is absolutely central to what goes on now in higher education. And so part of my presentation today is going to be showing you a whole series of book covers. And the book covers, I'm going to use them for two reasons. Three. One is I like book covers. The other is I want to send a message to you that everything I'm telling you this morning is not unique to me. There's nothing original about what I'm going to, well, maybe a couple things, but not many. Everything I'm telling you is common knowledge in the circles I move in higher education. There are a dozen books written about any topic I raised this morning, and I'd be happy to point you to those books. So basically what I'm doing is I'm building a wall around myself and saying, it's not as unusual as you think, and that this inquiry has been going on now for about 120 years, and there's an immense literature on it. And I just really want to emphasize that. My talk this morning is going to be divided into three very unequal parts. And each of the parts, I've given two C's to help you remember them. The first part is confusion and creativity. You can't really learn anything new until you unlearn something. And so I want to spend most of the talk this morning giving you example after example of just how confusing the history of sexuality and religion is. And there's a technical term in the field for this. They call it queering or queer. And they do not use this in a derogatory sense. These are mostly gay and lesbian intellectuals who talk about queering religion. And what they mean by that is that most people think of sexuality in very simplistic and dualistic terms. There are straight people and there are gay and lesbian peoples. In fact, that's not true. There's a spectrum, and the history of religions witnesses to this. And there's a lot of what we call gender bending. Men becoming women, women becoming men and women, you name it. It all goes on in religious symbols and in religious mythology. And you'll see some of this. You'll see a lot of it this morning. So my first goal is to confuse you and to explain why that is so creative and why that is so important, particularly to people like myself who have spent really most of their lives studying and trying to make sense of these things. That's by far the largest part. Yes?
You started to say, Yeah. Yes. Queering religion is showing that sexuality is fluid. It violates all dualities or simple systems that you try to give it. Human sexuality is not straight in any way. It can become straight, but generally speaking, it's not straight. It's Freud called it he called infants polymorphously perverse. And what he meant by that is they have sexual feelings all over their entire body, and their sexuality isn't focused on a particular kind of person yet. It's focused on a body part, on the mother's breast. It's focused all over their body. And so by queering religion, what they mean is to emphasize that human sexuality and human desire can't be mapped by just an either-or dichotomy. It's impossible. Even though that's exactly what the conservative religious traditions want to do. Okay? That's a violation of human nature. And I want to explain why. So, is that okay? Does that answer it? Okay, so the second part is called criticism and conservatism. And here, I want to explain why sexuality is such an important topic, both for intellectuals who are inevitably liberal in their political and social worldviews, and for fundamentalist leaders who are absolutely obsessed with sex and gender. And I want you to understand that both ends of the spectrum are correct to be obsessed about gender and sexuality. And I'll explain why. In other words, I'm going to explain to you what a liberal intellectual like myself and Focus on the Family have in common. Okay? Okay, finally, and very briefly, and this really gets us into tomorrow, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time with this. I want to just offer a kind of way of thinking about religion through what I call consciousness and culture. And this gets into more, I think, technicality, so I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. But I want just today to leave you with this idea that consciousness, you know, in our modern scientific worldview, we tend to think of consciousness as just a component of the brain. And in our modern worldviews, we tend to think of people as completely embedded in their own culture and time. And I want to suggest that's not really true. That, in fact, consciousness is not the same thing as culture, and that consciousness is constantly transforming culture, and that this is what the history of religion and the history, particularly of mysticism, is all about, is very radical human beings identifying with a kind of pure consciousness and denying their cultures and saying no to their cultures. And by doing that, they end up changing their cultures. And then those cultures then inform future generations who say no, and it's transformed, and it just goes on and on and on like this. So there's this constant feedback between spirit and society, or consciousness and culture. Okay, but that's a bit abstract, and I don't want to dwell on that. Okay, I want to start then with confusion and creativity. The common assumption on the street is that sex and spirit have nothing in common. And that to get to spirit, you have to leave sex behind. Okay? That's what we call dualism. That there are two things. There's spirit up here, and there's the dirty sex stuff down here, and you have to get away from this to get to this. Okay? And I think you can all recognize elements of that in your own religious training and upbringing. That is the standard model. Okay? If you listen to the news, I would suggest that virtually all discussion about religion in the news is really about sex. Okay? We have the political strategy of family values, which is really about patriarchy and reinstituting the power of the father over women and children in the household. That's a sexual issue. We have the ordination of married men or women in traditions like Roman Catholicism. That's a sexual issue. We have the issue of gay marriage in the Episcopalian Church. We have the never-ending traumas of priestly pedophilia in Catholicism. I can speak to that. We have the issue of abortion, which is ultimately a sexual issue. We have the veil in European Islam and the social status of women in conservative traditions like Islam or many forms of Hinduism. We have the fundamental inequality of the genders, which is the standard view in all traditional religious systems. Okay? Even that other religious item in the news, i.e. religious violence, is also sexualized or gendered. It is women and children who suffer most in these wars, and the martyrs who blow themselves up are promised what? They're promised virgin sex with the Huris, these heavenly maidens, which are an integral part of the Islamic tradition. So anyone who wants to suggest that sex and spirit have nothing in common needs to be ignoring a lot. Okay? Now, I'm not here, though, to address the news items or those hot-button issues. I want to address the deeper history of these. I want to show you why we have these problems and where all of this comes from. And I want to suggest my basic idea is that religion, what we call religion, is inscribed on the human body. It's inscribed into the most intimate recesses of our bodies and psyches. We experience it through desire and guilt and anxiety. We experience it when we eat food. Maybe not in this particular tradition, but most religions are all about what you eat and whom you have sex with. Those are the two big issues in any religious system. So religion isn't this abstract set of doctrines that you believe or don't believe. It's actually how you feel about your body. It's how you desire. It's whom you marry. It's what you eat. It's how you dress. It's all of these little things that we don't think about, but that in fact actually inscribe our worldview. So if religion is written into our bodies, the human body is the most effective conserver of religious values there is. If you're told to do something from the time you can remember and you've been doing it for decades, it's very hard not to believe what your body is doing and saying and feeling. Okay? This is how religion works. It works from within. It doesn't just work from without. But also, this is the key part. Because the human body is actually what conserves and transmits religious values, it's also what can destabilize and change those values. And so if you want to change a religious tradition, you don't go and argue with the minister. You change the bodily practice. That's how you change a tradition. This is why little things are big things. So, for example, I've been reading, to prepare for this group, I was reading into the journals of George Fox, and there are all these amazing passages on the hat honor, which you probably know more than I do about. The hat honor was Fox's refusal to tip his hat to his social seniors, whom, of course, was practically everyone. Because he refused to tip his hat, he was beat up and jailed, and early Quakers were threatened with death for not tipping their hat. Now, why? Because that little tip contains the entire social hierarchy in it. And if you don't tip, what you are denying is the entire social body. And so a single act of refusal like that can encode a massive revolution. The same with the Muslim veil. This is why the veil is such a hot issue in Europe. It seems like a no-brainer to us. Just take it off. But to take the veil off symbolizes a profound shift of worldview for Muslim women, and especially for Muslim men who control those women. And so the culture war is being fought over this little piece of cloth called, we call a veil. So these little things count huge, and nothing counts more than how you use your body and what you do with your body. And that's why all of these debates in the news are about what you do with your body sexually. Because if you change that, you will change the religion. Okay? Perfect example is the Protestant Reformation. What was one of the fundamental aspects of Catholicism that Martin Luther and the later reformers rejected? Celibacy. So Martin Luther's a monk. He's basically a professor of Bible. He's a monk. And what does he do? He leaves the monastery. He helps a nun escape the convent, Caterina von Bora, and they get married. That's the definitive symbolic act that helps create Protestantism. Once you remove celibacy as your primary way to God, you have changed the entire world. And that's what happened to Europe. The whole face of Europe changed because of those little moves. Now, I know it was more than just celibacy. It was a lot of things. But it's those shifts in behavior that happen, that create change. Okay. So now let me confuse you. The God of Abraham, which is the God of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, placed his mark, the sign of the covenant, where? On the foreskin, on the male sexual organ, on the tip of the penis. Okay? That is the founding ritual act of Western monotheism. Why did they do that? Circumcision was probably originally a fertility ritual in the ancient Middle East. You cut the penis to increase male virility. That was probably the idea. The early Hebrew community took that over through this revelation to Abraham, and it became the mark of what separated the Hebrew from the rest of the world. And they took it very, very seriously. If you read those early scriptures, people were killed. I mean, God tried to kill Moses because he wasn't circumcised. So this was a big deal. So the sign of this God is inscribed on the penis. So again, it's very hard to argue that sex and religion have nothing to do with one another. Also, by the way, this is a marvelous book. What Eilberg Schwartz and this man, Theodore Jennings, show is that there's a great deal of anxiety in the Hebrew Bible over God's body. And this is why one reason you can't see the front side of God, because you would see his penis, of course. So you can only see the backside of God. And if you've read the prophetic books, you know that Israel, which was always represented by males, men, Israel was feminized. Israel was the bride of God. And so this becomes the traditional way that male specialists relate to this male God. They become feminized. They become the brides of God. They become women. And this is what these two books are about. Also, I either remind you or I'll tell you that what split the early Christian churches off from the Jewish synagogues was, again, circumcision. This was the genius of Paul, you know, the apostle who wanted to take the gospel to communities outside the Jewish world. And he knew that to do this, Look, you're talking about marketing now, marketing to the youth. Could you imagine what kind of salesperson you'd need to do to sell a religion to male adults? And the first requirement was that we cut your penis? That is a hard sale. Yeah, I didn't mean that either. So when the Council of Jerusalem meets, the Council of Jerusalem meets in the year 50. You can read this in Acts 15. This is one of the first moves they've made. They said, we got to get rid of this circumcision thing. And by the way, we got to get rid of just about all the purity codes if we're going to make this thing work in the other parts of the world. And of course, that's what they did. So Christianity really was partly created on this issue of circumcision. Again, it's more than that. But that was a big, big deal. The same is true in Asia. Buddhism has been carried for its 2,500-year history now through male monks. That's the primary mode of Buddhism, is monasticism. And the first and most basic act on the male side is the rejection of women, sexuality, and the family. That is the primary religious act of Buddhism. Indeed, the Buddha's own calling involved what amounts to the abandonment of his wife and son in the middle of the night. If you read the story, he's a prince, and he has a wife, he has a very young son, and he gets up into the middle of the night and he rides away. He abandons them. That's the definitive act. Similarly with Jainism, probably a tradition you don't know as much about. Jainism has not translated well into Western culture, and you'll see why in a moment. Jainism is as old as Buddhism. It has a complicated ancient history, but it first comes onto the historical scene about the time of the Buddha through a man we now know as Mahavira, the great hero. It's highly, highly ascetic. And by that I mean Jainism believes that there is a purusha, a spirit, that's embedded in matter and the body, and the goal of Jainism is to completely separate the two so that the purusha or the spirit has nothing to do with the body or matter. So it's an absolute dualistic tradition. Its primary ritual expression in the ancient world was complete ritual nudity. So the monks didn't wear a stitch of clothing. And to this day, they do not wear a stitch of clothing. This became a problem, though, because of women. Women are always the problem. By the way, women wanted to become monks in Buddhism as well, and the Buddha didn't want them to. And he finally gave in. But they've had a very torturous presence in Buddhism from day one. The same is true in Jainism. There were female renouncers who wanted to be monastics. And so they, of course, were not going to wear clothes either. And the tradition said, whoa, 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 whoa. Men can be naked, but women cannot be naked. And so there were actually a large segment of the tradition that said women cannot achieve salvation because they cannot be naked. That was the argument. And so the argument was you'd have to be born again as a man to be saved or to be liberated. That's the argument in Buddhism as well for many, many centuries, that women cannot achieve full enlightenment, so they need to be reborn as men. So what happened in Jainism is it split into two basic sects, what are called the white-clad and the sky-clad. The white-clad were those who adopted a white monastic garment, and so you could have nuns now in there. The sky-clad is another way of saying naked. You're clad only with the sky, and they reject women as full monastics. So there again, in a religious tradition, it splits very early on a sexual issue. This is an image of Bahabalu, one of the founders of Jainism. There are these immense statues throughout India. And you can see the structure built over him. They pour hundreds of gallons of milk and ghee and honey and stuff over him during this ritual. And you can see it's full frontal male nudity as the central religious icon of the tradition. India. Yeah, and this, of course, is why Jainism doesn't travel well outside of India. Is, you know, how would you do that outside of India? And this is why, by different reason, why Hinduism originally did not travel well. There were the Hindus were forbidden to leave the country, to cross the black waters, because there's no caste system outside of India. So once you leave India, you leave your caste, you leave your world. Okay, so again, this notion of religions traveling is often extremely problematic and very modern. Then, of course, there's Hinduism in at least one of its major traditions, Shaivism, the worship of Shiva. Its central icon is the lingam yoni, or the yoni lingam. This is an image of the lingam. Lingam is Sanskrit for signifying mark. In other words, your gender. What marks you as a male? In other words, the phallus. And it's usually portrayed erect, like it is here. And interestingly enough, it's portrayed often inside a yoni or a vagina, which is what you have here. And in the ritual worship of it, you pour milk over the lingam and it runs down into the yoni and out that little trough there. I'll just tell you a funny story. When I lived in India, you have all of these linguistic complications. I was invited to dinner to a man's house, and we were just talking about our family, and I was going on and on about my cousin Joni. Joni does this, and Joni does that, and Joni does this, and does that. And the guy just turned white. His wife walked out, and I had no idea what was happening. And I was walking home, and I realized, in Bengali, which is what we were speaking, there's no Y. The Y turns into a J. And so I was saying, vagina does this and vagina does that, and it didn't go well. No, that's not why. Actually, they were very sweet to me. Of course, Tibetan Buddhism, those of you who are familiar with Tibetan Buddhism, you know that the central icon of Tibetan Buddhism is the Buddha in sexual intercourse with his ritual consort. And there's all kinds of elaborate symbolism around this and teachings and stuff. But again, it's a sexual image, and it's very clear that real sexual rituals are behind these images. Taoism, the famous yin-yang, Taoism's central symbol is often described in the tradition as a symbol of male and female in union. It's a metaphysical expression of human sexuality, again. Ancient Greece was a culture profoundly formed around male sexuality, and particularly male homosexuality. Eva Kools, a fine classicist, has written an entire book about this. She shows that the culture was organized around prostitution. They understood women and slaves as sexual possessions. There was a pottery tradition that featured every sexual act imaginable. Pederastic sexual intercourse with the sons of each other's social peers was how they organized their social life. In other words, male same-sex in ancient Greece was not about sex. It was about your place in society. And a social superior always penetrated a social inferior. In other words, they used sex to create the hierarchy of their culture.
It wasn't about being gay in the modern sense. It was about locating oneself in this culture. Also, the Greek males often proudly displayed their genitals in public, often to the ridicule of foreigners who thought it was hilarious. My favorite poet, William Blake. Anyone who's read Blake knows that sexuality is a major theme in his art and his poetry. One of my colleagues, Marcia Keith Shukard, wrote a book called Why Mrs. Blake Cried, in which she explores Blake's erotic mysticism and looks at some of his drawings that are not often shown. This is one of them. This is what are called the Watchers. The Watchers are angelic figures in the apocryphal literature, and these are the figures that were believed to have sex with the women, the human women in Genesis 5 or 6. Remember that passage? And here, a woman is essentially touching the immense phallus of one of the watchers as she looks at the phallus of another watcher. So this is, and the phalluses are have light coming out of them. They're luminous. So again, Blake's notion of a kind of sacred sexuality. Here also is a very striking drawing that Blake did. He drew a chapel in a woman's vagina. To send the message, Marcia argues that what she calls the visionary vulva and the sacrality of female sexuality. So this is Blake. This is, you know, 18th century, early 19th century. By the way, why you want to know why Mrs. Blake cried? Because Will wanted to experiment with an Eden of sexuality that involved multiple sexual partners. And why not? As Jesus had it in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 22:30, if you want to look it up, there is no marriage in heaven. So the famous Oneida community in 19th century upstate New York was founded by a charismatic preacher named John Humphrey Noyes. Noyes created a utopian community for decades that practiced a kind of communal sexuality in something he called complex marriages, which essentially meant multiple partners. And the key, though, was male continence. And by that, Noyes meant that the male doesn't ejaculate. So you have all the sex you want, but you don't ejaculate. Why? Because he felt that pregnancy was what was dragging women down, and that pregnancy after pregnancy after pregnancy restricted women to very drudgerous social positions, and that it often resulted in death. And so he wanted to not have as many pregnancies, essentially. And so the community developed this notion of complex marriage and male continence. By the way, the Oneida community were also very successful business people. They sold animal traps and, of course, silverware. So you didn't know your dinner table was so interesting on that. This is a volume a colleague of mine at Amsterdam and I just, it's been out for a while, called Hidden Intercourse. It's a collection of essays on how sexuality is framed in the history of Western esoteric movements from the ancient period to the modern period. I won't talk a lot about the book, but just say one of the essays is by my colleague April DeConnick. April is in the same department with me at Rice, and she's an expert on ancient Christian Gnosticism. And she writes about what's called the bridal chamber. The bridal chamber was a sexual sacrament that these early Christians practiced between married couples. And they believed that by engaging in sexual intercourse in a sacramental fashion, they were ushering in the kingdom. And this, by the way, is where the Mary Magdalene stuff comes from. They, of course, needed a model for this. And so they imagined that Jesus needed a sexual partner. And so they put Mary Magdalene in there. So a lot of the Dan Brown Gnostic stuff traces back there. There's also a lot of others. I'm going to just
move quickly through a lot of this. Shamans are often transgendered figures in these tribal traditions. They're often cross-dressers. They often have homosexual proclivities. All of these things were seen as signs of holiness and charismatic power. The holy man was the man set apart from the rest of the community, often through his sexuality. Medieval magic and witchcraft, of course, were also heavily sexualized and, alas, demonized. The traditional image of the devil, the guy with the fork and the tail and the cloven feet, almost certainly comes from the Greek god Pan, the fertility god of the forest. So what the Christians did is they took a fertility god and they demonized it. They turned sex into something evil. And so you get the horrible witch trials and inquisitions of early modern Europe. Sex is also an integral part of the paranormal and psychical phenomena. Anyone who's read deeply enough into seances and spiritualism knows that a lot of spiritualism was about having sex with spirits and getting married in heaven. And sometimes it became even more dramatic. There's the I'm going to show you this next one, ectoplasm. A lot of this was fraudulent, of course. I'm not suggesting these particular things happen. But note, ectoplasm, the point that we keep in mind here is that when a lot of psychics or mediums who were mostly women would come out of their trances, particularly one named Eusapia Palladino, she would be very horny. And she would basically attack her male researchers. So there were all these people from Cambridge and Tides like me, and they go to study Eusapia, and she basically hits on them coming out of her trances. And this ectoplasm came out of any and every orifice. Oh, this is the magical tradition, modern magical tradition in the States with Aleister Crowley. And this is one picture of the ectoplasm. You can see that the sexuality is very apparent. Then there was that charismatic Jewish healer and mystic we call Jesus of Nazareth. There is a very large literature on the sexualities of Jesus. It's completely scandalous and shocking to anyone who hasn't been reading it for 20 years. This is a wonderful book. I highly recommend it. It's called... wow, that's really a bad image. It's called Sex and the Single Savior. Look, the fundamental fact of the Gospels is that Jesus was not married. There's no evidence whatsoever that he was married. He was a single man. Not only was he a single man who wasn't married, he relied on wealthy women for support and seemed to prefer the company of prostitutes and sinners. Far from being some Republican voting family man, he openly encouraged his disciples to hate their mothers and fathers, to abandon their families, and above all, not to call any man father. He clearly hated the word father. So this family values thing. No man on earth. Yeah, God was father, but you couldn't refer to any human as father. So this whole family values thing is the absolute reverse of what the historical Jesus appears to have been preaching. It's in the Gospels. Those are all straight out of the Gospels. Yeah. No, but as the Gospels stand, I can get those for you. Happy to do that. Yeah. Abba. Yeah, that's God. Yeah. Yeah, no, God's Father. Yeah, but not humans. There's also the issue of the birth stories and the illegitimacy of Jesus. There are only two birth narratives. John and Mark have no birth narrative in them. They're only in Matthew and Luke. And it looks very much to a reader who doesn't assume
the virgin birth stuff, that Mary was a pregnant teenager and a very young one and in great danger because Jewish law prescribed stoning for a pregnant teenager, regardless of how she got pregnant. We don't know how Mary got pregnant. We're not told in either gospel. We know that Joseph took her in. This is a colleague of mine named Jane Schaberg, who wrote a book on this issue. It's a very powerful book. I highly recommend it. Jane has taught her whole life at a Catholic university in Detroit. She works with the poor. She's very socially active, very socially concerned. She wrote this book partly to do good biblical criticism, partly to get us to rethink how we think about unwed teenage mothers. Schaberg, S-C-H-A-B-E-R-G. For writing this book, Jane's car was blown up in her driveway. She was almost fired from her university, and she suffered years of hate mail. So again, to speak these truths, I want to keep coming back to that. These are not easy issues. Prayer and what? Not that I know of. Can you read that? Oh man, you can't see the picture. This is another fine book called The Man Jesus Loved. It's a queer or homoerotic reading of the Gospels, which is very easy to do. Ted Jennings shows that Jesus did have a beloved disciple, of course, in the Gospel of John, who was another man. Jesus made a point of violating the various purity codes of Judaism, which were central to the piety of the time. This, of course, is partly what got him killed, is that he kept offending the religious authorities. In the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus even holds up the example of the castrated eunuch without wife or children as a model disciple who is most serious about the kingdom of heaven. So a eunuch is, of course, a castrated male. What you don't know is that eunuchs were feminized in the ancient world and were often assumed to engage in homosexual activity. So that's quite the saying from Jesus. That, of course, is also, by the way, that's 1912, if you want to look it up, Matthew 1912. That's also the proof text for clerical celibacy in Catholicism. And again, I can't emphasize enough how difficult this is for people to accept. I mean, I wrote one essay years ago for the University of California Press, which is a very good press, in which I cited this passage and even gave the Greek. The Greek's very clear. And the copy editor refused. He said, "You can't be right. You can't put this in. It has to be wrong." I'm like, "It's not wrong. It's right there. Just read the Greek." And he just wouldn't believe me, no matter what I told him. Because it so violates what people assume to be in there that they can't process it. And I think that's part of the power of it. This is another fantastic book. Do you know that book, Jim? It's fantastic. William Countryman, Dirt, Greed, and Sex. What he shows is that the genius of Christianity in the ancient world, in both the teachings of Jesus and Paul, is that they went after the purity codes and they consistently violated them and denied them. That's the genius of the gospel, is that it doesn't discriminate people based on their gender or whether they're menstruating or whether they've touched a corpse or anything else. That's what the gospel is about. And Countryman tries to show this through all of these passages. So again, for the religious right to return to the purity codes and to go back to Leviticus is to completely deny the gospel message, which is that purity codes have nothing to do with us anymore. I just like this cover. This is the most powerful book I know of. If you want a single book on Catholicism and homosexuality, read Mark Jordan. Mark is a dear friend. He taught at Notre Dame, then he moved to Emory. Now he sits in the Niebuhr Chair of Theology at Harvard Divinity School. So that's a very good sign. It means that at least the academy and the elite universities have embraced this point of view. Mark is a convert, by the way, to Catholicism. Very interesting. He's a gay man, a queer theologian, a convert to Catholicism, and he writes about how Catholicism is a both profoundly homoerotic for men and profoundly homophobic in its teachings, and how those two things sort of create this spin and sort of propel the tradition from within. And we can talk about that later if you want, but it's a very powerful thesis. I think it's, when I read this book, I felt like I was reading a blueprint of my seminary experience. It was so precise. There's also, of course, Plato. We could talk about Plato, who's really the origin of all Western mysticism, or most of it. Neoplatonism, Christian mysticism, Jewish Kabbalah, and Islamic Sufism are all go back to Plato and Neoplatonism. And for Plato, of course, the love of boys is the heavenly love, and the love of women is vulgar love. The philosopher, the lover of wisdom, is the older male who can take his desire for younger males, not act on it, sublimate it, until it becomes wings and you can ascend to the heavenly realm and see the divine ideas. Okay? So this is integral to this is the philosophical tradition we're talking about now, the same patterns. Also, our word gym and gymnasium, gymnos is Greek for naked. All the Greek gymnasiums, they were males, they were all naked. And the Olympics, by the way, were also celebrated in complete nudity, which sort of changes how I feel about the Winter Olympics. But let's forget about Plato and Jesus and all those other figures. Go back to the very beginning of Western religion. Go back to Genesis and the Adam and Eve story, and here we are again. We're right in the lap, as it were, of the goddess and human sexuality. In chapter 1, of course, the gods, it's plural, says we're going to make Adam in our own image, male and female, which implies that God is bisexual. Then in the later chapters, Adam, in the rabbinic tradition, Adam, it means dirt person or dirt being. In other words, the being made out of the soil. And Adam in the rabbinic tradition is an androgyne, both male and female, until God separates woman out of man, and then you have us. You have sexual difference at that point. But the original being that God created was both male and female in the rabbinic tradition, and I think that's actually a very accurate reading. Of course, what happens in the story is Eve takes the fruit from the serpent, who promises her the knowledge of good and evil, which she in fact gets. And the young couple eat the fruit, and they immediately become aware of their genitals. So the fruit of the garden has something to do with sexuality. We also know this because in the ancient world, the punishment always fits the crime. If you steal something, you get your hand cut off. If you poke somebody's eye out, you get your eye poked out. That's how the legal system worked. So what are the punishments of Adam and Eve? Eve will suffer in what? Childbirth, which is the result of sex. So her crime was sex. Her punishment is suffering in childbirth. Adam will suffer how? Work where? In the fields. Agriculture was a sexual activity for men. You're plowing your seed. The soil, all of that agricultural symbolism was about male sexuality. So the punishments fit the crime perfectly. The ancient authors knew this. They wrote about this constantly. A medieval Jewish mystic by the name of Abraham Abulafia put it this way. He wrote,
Intercourse is called the tree of knowledge of good and evil and is a matter of disgust, and one ought to be ashamed at the time of the act. So the ancient Christian and Jewish authors knew perfectly well that the Adam and Eve story was on one level about human sexuality. And I think one of the tragedies of Western religious history is that that story then is identified with the fall, with original sin, and so you have sex connected to sin. And so by the time you get to Augustine, Augustine's arguing that the original sin is actually passed on in the sexual act. And so again, you get this continuous linkage of sin and sex. We know this as well in the modern world. We talk about so-and-so as forbidden fruit, right? So we know this. And we also know that to know is a sexual euphemism. When Adam knew Eve, he wasn't friending her on Facebook. Or Twitter, yeah. So the other reason I really like the Adam and Eve story is it's very honest about the space we are in when we ask these difficult questions, because it encodes both our desire to know about sex and the spirit, which is the young couple and the snake, and our desire not to know, which is represented by this petty, angry God who kicks the young couple out for wanting to know about their own bodies. And so that need to know and that desire not to know are both sort of held in tension there. Okay. Let's skip that. Let's move to criticism and conservatism. How are we doing, by the way? Do we want to talk some now, or do we... Okay. I want to talk a bit about why both liberal intellectuals and conservative religious ideologues are both obsessed with sex and gender. And I think you already know the answer. The answer is that's where you form your worldview, and that's where you change your worldview. And if you form and you change your worldview on the human body, and your goal is to study human culture and how it changes, what are you going to study? You're going to end up studying the body. You're going to end up studying sex and gender. And so I want to give you a single thought experiment to take away from today, and then we're going to end here. And I call this the seed and soil exercise. Okay? All the world's major religions arose either in agricultural societies or in urban areas that were heavily dependent on agriculture. They knew little, if anything, of modern science or astronomy, much less of organic chemistry, evolutionary biology, astrophysics, you name it. They knew nothing. They were particularly ignorant of human sexuality. They almost universally understood human sexuality through agricultural metaphors. And those two metaphors were seed and soil. And I want to suggest to you that these symbols had devastating consequences, particularly on women. And this is how it happens. In the agricultural experience, you have a seed, and the essence of that plant is entirely in that seed. And you plant it in soil. It doesn't matter what soil, as long as it's fertile and it gets water. That seed will become the plant you planted, regardless of where the soil is. Can we all agree on that? So if you carry over that symbolism to human sexuality, what do you get? The essence and soul of the person is where? Is in the male seed. And the dirt or the ground of the woman is the possession of the sower. And he plants his seed in that soil, and he owns that seed, and he owns that farm, and it's his. And so in every ancient tradition that I'm aware of, male comes to stand in for self, for spirit, for transcendence, for God. And dirt or soil comes in to stand for female, for matter, for earth, and for death. Okay? Those are, if you will, archetypes. And they're devastating. They're absolutely devastating. This also carried into the philosophical tradition. Aristotle, for example, he talked about the active male principle as form and the passive female substance as matter. And so here again, you have an active male force and a passive female force. This is why and how you get the sexual codes of the ancient religions. This is what produces Leviticus. This is what produces the obsession with female virginity. This is what produces the prohibition on male homosexuality in Leviticus. And I'll explain why. In the ancient world, the father could never be certain that the child was his. The Latin was pater semper incertus est. The father is always uncertain. My wife, who's from South Chicago, has her own version, which goes like this. Mama's baby, papa's maybe. So if the patriarch cannot be certain that the child is his, what is he going to do? He is going to create a system that can guarantee that his seed gets into that soil and no one else's. And this is why you get female virginity. This is why young women are married at astonishingly low ages in most cultures. Because you can get them before they start to menstruate, before they're fertile, and then you know you got them and someone else didn't impregnate them. Okay? This is why male same-sex acts were prohibited by Leviticus. Because you cannot get a male heir through two men having sex. Can't happen. It had nothing to do with what we call morality. Absolutely nothing. It had to do with preserving the male heir and guaranteeing a son. Okay? So the story I always tell here, you know, if you read Genesis, you know there was something called the Law of Levi. And the Law of Levi was that if there was a string of sons, you always married off the oldest son first because his son would become your heir. It always followed the eldest son. So let's say we got five brothers. You marry off the oldest brother and he dies. He gets kicked by a goat or something and dies. The next brother in line had to step in and impregnate his wife. And if he dies, then the next brother and the next brother and the next brother. It had nothing to do again with what we mean by morality. It had to do with impregnating the right wife by the right male and guaranteeing this lineage. This is also why you get dowries in most parts of the world. The woman is the possession of the men, and you trade women. Women are sexual objects that you trade, and you trade them through dowries. So I'll marry my daughter off to you if you give me a new refrigerator and a car or something. That's how it works to this day in many parts of the world. And this is why women are terrified of divorcing. Because if they get divorced, they have to give the dowry back. And so there's huge pressure on keeping women as property. So here's the crunch then. If that symbolism has created so much inequity and so much sexual suffering, why do we hold on to it? Particularly now that we know it's fundamentally wrong. We know that a human being has an absolute even genetic code, 23 chromosomes from the male, 23 from the female, and we know about cell division, and we know it's absolutely even. It has nothing to do with the male putting all of his essence in the woman and it coming out that way. So this is why This is why intellectuals like myself are so concerned and so interested in sexuality. It's not that we're perverted. It's not that we're horny. It's that we are completely convinced that worldviews and cultures are encoded in sexuality, and that those codes have created untold suffering, particularly for women and children, and that if those systems are going to change, you have to go after the religious systems. You cannot, this is politically incorrect to say, but it will not do to take this position that all religions are okay and that all religious symbolisms are equally good, because some create suffering and others don't. And that's part of this psychological turn again. Once you make that turn, you can then look out and see what's creating suffering and what's not, and you can change it. But until you make that turn, you can't do any of that. Because if I gave this lecture to many communities in my home state of Texas, assuming I would be still sitting here, they would just quote Bible to me for 2 hours. And because they're reading the Bible literally, I have no response to that, because I don't read the Bible literally. I read it historically and symbolically. And so it really comes down to how one is reading the scriptures and how one is being religious and what kind of world we want to live in. And I would suggest that we're not going to change the world until we change our symbolisms. So thank you very much. Okay, good. Good. So, okay. There are no questions, right?
There was a question I have an answer to. Somebody said, is there any book of prayer and sex? My book that I wrote is called Fertile Prayers, and it's for people with infertility and miscarriage and barrenness and sterility, and sex and prayers is included in a daily devotional.
Yes. Hello? I'm interested in the Adam and Eve thing and the rabbinical sources about the Adam.
Yeah.
Where would I look for that stuff?
Right. There's a wonderful book. I can get you the citation later when I look it up. But it's called Eve and Adam, and it's a reader on 2,000 years of biblical commentary on the Adam and Eve story. And I highly, highly recommend it. They look at it in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It's wonderful. Even Adam, it's called. The other thing that's really interesting about that story, which other people have picked up on, is God doesn't seem to know what sexual partner Adam needs. So he keeps bringing him animals. And commentators have noted this and said, well, clearly God doesn't know, which means we decide what kind of partner we want. And, of course, Adam picked Eve, but other people pick Adam. You know, Adam sometimes does pick Adam, and Eve picks Eve. And so there's also this ambiguity in the story as well. You know, I'll have to get that. There are three authors. And I their names aren't in my head right now, but I'm happy to get that for you.
I want to make a comment.
Okay.
And I want to tell you right in front of everyone, you're the speaker that I have come here for years to hear. And thank you for blowing the scales off my eye.
I just wanted to point out that George Fox used the image of the seed a lot in his journal as the inner light or the God within. And I always thought it was a very appropriate symbol because it suggests, you know, that this is something that grows slowly if you work on it, if you water it, if you, you know, put it in good soil, it will grow, but grow slowly. And, you know, so anyway, there's a different symbol besides, I wouldn't want to throw out that symbol.
Yeah, that Walter, that's a really important point I didn't make, is that I don't want to suggest that all religious language and symbolism is sexual. It's not. There are lots of religious frames that have nothing to do with sex. But a lot do. And when you study religion, you have to focus. You focus on one theme or one comparative pattern. So I've studied the sexual ones. But I would never suggest for a minute that every mystic or every system is sexual. And I would suggest that if you have an image like an ocean or a light, it would be very friendly to a kind of gender equity where a father god would not be friendly. So in some ways, your example, I think, undergirds my argument, is that the religious symbolism really matters.
Is this on?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Just a comment. My late wife gave some money to the seminary I graduated from, the Center for Christian Spirituality. And the first K. Butler Gill lecture happened this year, and it was on love mysticism. Janet Ruffing, who was a sister, Catholic sister, gave a very, I think, a very modern and very open and un-Catholic in some ways, a paean, actually, to the eroticism of some of the mystics.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wanted to say that.
Yeah. My first introduction to this was through Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross, who, of course, were profoundly erotic in their writings and experiences.
I want to thank you for this very powerful lecture and, you know, showing how dangerous some religions are. But I'm wondering, how do you account for Crete? I think they were Crete. I think
Crete.
Their religion was matriarchal,
yeah.
And I guess there are other examples. How did that happen, do you think?
Yeah. There's a lot of discussion of the sort of matriarchal eras before patriarchy. And the truth is, I just don't know enough about those prehistorical periods. They tend to be prehistorical, by which I simply mean we don't have anything in writing. We have temples and we have, for example, cave art or those little figurines that shown up all across Europe. But scholars debate, actually, whether those are truly matriarchal or not. And both female and male scholars take both sides. The most dramatic example of this, there's a wonderful book whose title escapes me now, but it's a feminist scholar, it's a woman, and she looks at this matriarchal reading of these Venus figurines that we've all seen. Mm-hmm. And she does something really subversive. She says, look, these may have been goddesses that were being worshipped, but what they look like to me is cave pornography. And so she shows a Venus figurine right next to a modern Playboy or penthouse, and she shows how the positions are identical. And so she's trying to get us to question whether there really was a matriarchy before the patriarchy, not because she's against matriarchy, but she wants us to understand that our concerns as modern people are modern concerns, and that we don't need a precedent in the past to argue for a moral position. And that's a very difficult place to be, I think. Everybody wants to argue that their position is grounded in the past, and it's not. We just know more now. We have to admit to ourselves that we know more than our ancestors did. And we have to face that, and we have to go forward and not keep pretending that they knew all the things we know, because they didn't. Yeah, and they may have been. I'm not denying that. I just don't know. It's not my area.
I think you just commented what I was sitting here wondering, what's wrong with me? Am I masochistic? I love being a woman. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
I have the names of the authors of I have the names of the authors of Eve and Adam, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim readings on Genesis and gender.
That's it.
Kristen K-V-A-M.
Vom.
Vom. Linda Schering and Valerie Ziegler.
Yep, that's it. Just Google Eve and Adam.
Right.
Go to Amazon.
It's on Amazon.
When you go to Amazon to buy all my books, go just also after that. Type in Eve and Adam.
Okay, I don't know if it's on. It is on. Okay. You started this lecture by saying something about what you, as a liberal theologian...
Intellectual, yeah. I'm not
intellectual,
a theologian.
Yeah. Liberal intellectual. And focus on the family had in common.
Yeah.
I would be interested in you going on with that. You also made the statement that we need new symbols for new dialogue. I'm interested in how we do that.
Yeah.
And one reason I'm interested in that is that, as many people here have, you know, I'm a Quaker, liberal bent, very much so. I have a stepdaughter who is born again. How do I talk to her? How do we change these things? How do we change the dialogue? What symbols do we change? What can we do?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a three-part question. What James Dobson and I have in common is that we're both obsessed with sex, but for completely different reasons. He understands that the family, the patriarchal family, is the stable core of his worldview, and that if you allow gays to get married or women to work or whatever, his worldview will come apart. He knows that, and that's why he's so hysterical about what look to us like little things. And what I'm saying is he's right to be hysterical, because when those things change, his worldview will be no more. Now, I think that's a good thing. He thinks that's a horrible thing. So, but we share the view that much of it hinges on the patriarchal family and how that's handled. In terms of how to do religious dialogue, this is where I'm afraid I fail you. When I was in the seminary, I left because I came to the conclusion that I couldn't say from the pulpit what I really thought. My ministry would have lasted 6 months. So I did the easy thing, and I left the ministry, and I became a professor where I'm paid to say exactly what I think. And I get a little protection through something called tenure. But that's the easy way out. The tough way in, and I have graduate students who are ministers, and I beg them to stay in the ministry and to stay in the churches so that they can do what I couldn't do, which is to develop these dialogues and these methods to actually use this stuff on the ground. Which is all to say, I don't know how to do it. I don't see that as my calling. A very simple thing, though, would be to stop. Anytime you see the symbolism of seed and soil, question it. Call it out, and form your religious lives around things like the inner light, you know, which are completely neutral when it comes to gender. So I think we can do little things. In terms of your child, who's now an evangelical, I wouldn't use reason.
I don't think reason will work. I think those things can only be addressed by relationships, and at some point the time will come where you can say something or do something. But evangelical fundamentalism has erected a very elaborate defense mechanism around itself. It has an answer for everything. And they're just going to pull some Bible text out of somewhere and beat you back with it. But you might simply point out that you read the same Bible, you just read it differently. It's not about the Bible, it's about how we read the Bible. It's not about whether we're religious or not, it's how we're religious. So I know that's not a satisfying answer, but it's really the only answer I have.
Loy? I showed the first slides of women, symbols of women, back the Venus figures were there at this conference, first time in the early 1980s. And we've had conferences on women. I think the most influential thing we've done is Elenid Kochnig's pamphlet on women in life. We have videos in our Dora Wilson Library on exactly this subject. You and I took a workshop 20 years ago, Barbara Walker's Women of Age, Wisdom, and Power. In the first chapter, she knocks Christianity powerfully. It's here. It's among us. And all we have to do is look. This is the most brilliant explanation of so many things I've been chewing on for so many years, and I'm really grateful for this. And how can we all move forward with our feet on this firm ground now? No more little pictures and videos, but let's go forward, please, friends. Religion and psychology. Thank you.
Oh. Yeah. If I could, your comments reminded me of something else I could have said to this previous question. To me, the most... Yeah, is it Loy? I can't read you. Loy? I call this the Trojan horse method. It involves Jesus. To me, there's no more radical teacher on gender and sex than Jesus. And there's no way to fit what he says in the Gospels into this family values campaign. There's no way to do it. The only reason they get away with it is nobody knows what they're talking about. So if you were simply to read the book Sex and the Single Savior or The Man Jesus Loved, it would A, blow your mind, and you would have all sorts of passages, Bible passages, to share with your son that absolutely subvert this notion of family values. And so I think there is a great resource in Christianity, and it's the Gospels, but again, it depends on how you read them. So really, all of these battles that we're in right now really are battles about how to read, how to interpret. Well, there's two I put up there. One is called Sex and the Single Savior by Dale Martin. The other is called The Man Jesus Loved by Ted Jennings. I summarize all of this scholarship in the first chapter of The Serpent's Gift in an essay called The Apocryphon of the Beloved, and it's on the sexualities of Jesus. So you can get the whole thing in one chapter there, and then if you want to go and really dig in, read Dale's book, read Ted's book.
I think that part of an answer to some of the questions is that the friend's faith is not rooted in fear. And what you described as the root of this dirt seed is fear. that somehow if my wife or the woman I am with in those prehistoric premarital days has a baby, that somehow it won't be mine. Well, we know that doesn't make any difference. We don't have any reason for that kind of bizarre fear. And in my experience, most religion is rooted in fear. And that stepdaughter, I'd be listening to her for her feelings and bringing out the roots in her grasping for that fundamentalist answer as fear, and ask her, as I asked ministers years ago, who none of them, now we're all Protestant, and none of them turned out to preach in the pulpit what they believed, because they couldn't live with the horrible consequences if you were asked, could you really imagine Jesus watching people, his creatures, burn for eternity? Is that Jesus who preached love, forgiveness? They couldn't live with it. But if your fear, if your faith is rooted in fear, then our minds don't work very well up here in the prefrontal cortex. And I think that's part of an approach.
Well, look, the Quakers are not the problem here. Right? And the genius of what we've seen as the religious right in the last 8 years of this country is that they went right to the back, they went right to the mammalian part of the brain, and they hit the fear button over and over and over again. What they were saying made absolutely no sense to the prefrontal cortex. It's all nonsense, but it hit back here, and it worked. It worked. But again, I want to just really emphasize, traditional religious systems, even if they're not based on fear, they're based largely on what you eat and whom you have sex with. I can't emphasize that enough. If Hinduism, for example, is an elaborate caste system of purity codes that are very similar to ancient Judaism, and they completely relegate people to different statuses depending on their caste, and you can't eat or can eat, depending on that. You have sex or don't have sex. I mean, it's all-encompassing. The same is true in most parts of the Islamic world, in many parts of Asia. It's not. It's a universal fact before the modern world that religions worked through these prohibitions and taboos. And most of them had to do with eating and having sex. So if we want to live in a different world where people are free and equal, we're never going to get there by being friendly to these ancient religions, folks. It's a really hard point, and it's politically incorrect, but it's the truth. So for me, let me say one more thing. I don't think it's our role necessarily to change those religions. I think it's the people in those religions to change them. So we have to figure out how to reach people in any community, whether it's here or there, and make them the yeast of their own dough. Not us. We're not. That's just. I think that's where it does slide into imperialism and colonialism. But the fact is, something like feminism, for example, that yeast is spread through the whole planet. You know, there are feminists. There are fiery feminists in every country I know of, that I've ever been in, and that's a Western. That's a very much a Western system, but they've picked it up and run with it. So I think we can be yeast, but we can't be their yeast.
Stand up, please. Stand up, please.
About the dialogue, I still wanted to say a little bit about that to Loy and others. I think how the dialogue is done, if we are going to reach across those bridges, because I and many others know people we like and love and work with and need to talk to them, I think a lot of that lies in the area of nonviolent communication and conflict resolution communication. And both I, as a liberal Christian, and many friends here, Quakers, we need to go by the inward light, do some self-talk about that. especially when I feel the excitement, the adrenaline building, that feeling in my stomach, the red in the back of my neck. I need to take deep breaths, go to the inward light. And also do some methodical practice of forgiveness, which started for me, at least it helped me a lot, with a small group I took here 3 or 4 years ago, which immediately affected my life, taught my Sula Reagan. But that whole area is, apart from what you're saying about letting the yeast rise in the other communities.
Yeah.
We've got to keep that yeast in us. I've heard preachy, righteous indignation from the left, from Quakers, from my fellow Christians, my fellow liberal Christians.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I think, you know, you didn't address this, but for some reason your words remind me. I think the only long-range solution, I'd say there are three solutions. One is to, globally now, is to educate women is the first solution. The second solution is to educate more women. And the third solution is to educate even more women. Because educated women don't put up with this. And uneducated women do. And so that's the yeast right there. And all of these systems are built by men who saw women as possessions. And so the most effective method is not to go argue with the men. You'll lose. The method is to educate their daughters and wives, who will then tell them what they really think. And those of you who are married know how this works. So I really think, that's a long range. That's the problem with all of our problems. None of them have short-term answers. They're long-term generational issues, not short-term tactical issues.
Just something I noticed, I've been noticing, there's a cultural shift that's going on here too. You know, the whole business of DNA, 23andMe, it knocks the heck out of the business of who's the heir.
Yeah, of course.
And so that whole thing is gone. There must be, this is huge reverberations in the cultural world as a result of, if you want to find out if a kid is yours or not, you can.
Yeah, no, I agree. But that needs to sink down now into our religious worldviews and our assumptions and language.
Topic of educating women. I would really appreciate suggestions from you all for books for my preschool granddaughters.
It's preschool. Oh, okay.
Okay.
Them too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We really have to get moving.